just before we got started, John was, you know, asking about, you know, some of the newer members. And what's interesting about my decision to become ordained was that in 2015, the abbot, when I was in the abbot's office, we were talking about Father Mark was, coming close,
coming close to death,
and Father Boniface wasn't well either. So we were thinking about numbers, and there were no prospects for vocations, and so we said, well, would you be interested in being ordained? So I said, yes, I would. I said, but I'm approaching 60. Mm-hmm. He said, well, that's not too old. So I was having second thoughts about it because of that fact. I was just, not that I was feeling real old, but but what's so interesting, as soon as I said yes, and enrolled at the seminary, Simon Clayton comes. A couple of months after him, Brother Osiel comes. And both are, now they're starting seminary. Osiel, like myself, already had a lot. He did most of his studies in Spain. He was part of another religious community before. So he doesn't have very long to go. And then Brother Lewis came with the interest of transferring from the Trappists. And a lot of people here remember Brother Francis, who he was here, then he left, got dispensed from vows. He was away for 15 years. He's come back. And this is all happening close, very close. A monk from Senegal, I think probably everybody's met Father Francois, he's come here. He's enrolled at College of St. Elizabeth for a PhD program in counseling psychology, but also interested in transferring to our monastery. And then, I thought he was supposed to come this weekend, but there's another candidate, a young guy who is completing his studies to the priesthood. He was at St. John's University. And he was a member of this secular institute. Not a secular institute, I guess you would call it. It's an institute. It's not a, like an institute like ours. They don't have a lot of community life. I can't remember. Brother Lewis, you remember the name of that institute?
Veritas Dei.
Veritas Dei? Okay. So he's coming, and he's interested in. He met Brother Osiel and Brother Simon out at St. John's. They went out there for some. It was a week program,
yeah,
right?
Some retreat or something.
He met them. He got interested, and then we have this other guy,
Jose Pablo.
Wow. He knows more than I. Jose Pablo, who's
he's younger.
Yeah, they're young guys, yeah. And he's also a member of the Augustinians, like Brother Osiel was, and he's a friend of Brother Osiel. And it was through Brother Osiel he got interested. So he's coming in December.
Oh, good. Wow.
So we got all these. It's just like, I don't know if it's just coincidental. It's just, as soon as I said yes to becoming a priest, all of a sudden you got this influx of new vocations.
I think God wanted you.
And almost all of them able to be a priest.
That's wonderful.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Did you say that Sam is studying for the Christian?
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
That's great.
So,
when are you
all our prayers will be answered. Our prayers are being answered.
That little petition on Sunday works.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that, see, in 2005, I remember it was the beginning, I think it was early 2005, I think it was 2004, I went to Steubenville with Brother Patrick to a vocation fair. They have, every year they have a big vocation fair, and we set up a table. And, well, I would go around to all these stations with these religious communities, and I was trying to find, you know, the ingredient that was common to all these communities that are getting vocations. And it seemed like it, every one of them was doing a holy hour. So it was like, you know, the beginning of 2005, or sometime before the beginning of 2005, I had brought it up in a chapter meeting. We should do have a holy hour. And the abbot said, okay. So the only, there was no place to put it in the day except at 5 o'clock in the morning. But but anyway, but I've been consistent with it, Father Albert. And see, the others who come, you know, don't come for the whole thing. You know, they come for part of it. That's all right, as long as people get in there and spend some time before the Blessed Sacrament.
Right.
So I feel that's been like, you know, 12 years that's played a role.
Yeah.
The other thing I have to say, I know that there are people that say, you're doing good work with your school. You're doing a lot of good things, and you pray on the side. And that is not the attitude of the monks here. The attitude of the monks is very much that that school, that everything they do, is heavily dependent on the prayer. I was up this morning with them at their morning prayer, and there is a very strong feeling that comes through when you're there, and I have to say, ultimately that will attract vocations. The holy hour is a factor, their intense prayer life is another factor, and you know, I'm sorry, but the so-called 70s business of, well, just go out and do good for people and you don't need to pray, that doesn't cut it. It doesn't cut it long term, but that's another issue, I think. And that's as an outsider.
It's funny, you mentioned that 70s thing, you know, Father, Father John Gorski, who's still in the infirmary, you know, had all kinds of problems. But he said, you know, because he went through with the Marinoles, they were missionary anyway. But at a certain point in the early 70s, most of them stopped doing the divine office. They stopped doing the breviary. And he said that he stopped doing, and they stopped doing daily mass. And he said, for years, a day, say, it wasn't even doing the whole rosary, a Hail Mary every day. But he said, you know, he said it was, you know, he saw that there was some kind of emptiness, you know. And so that, that mentality where, you know, it's, because this is going to fit right into what I want to talk about today, but that Pelagian, like, doing good works, the emphasis gets so much on the works that you throw out, you know, the spiritual life. And then to what extent are good works really charity if it's done, you know, just for human reasons rather than for divine reason, for, you know, to serve God, right? So their desire for social justice is good, you know, but even Jesus, he didn't come for social justice. He said, you can have the poor with you always. You know, he said that he didn't come to change, not in a sense, but in a spiritual sense more. I mean, eventually we'll have, when his second coming, we'll have a real transformation of the earth, so it's going to be without poverty and war and famine and hurricanes.
And would you clear up, is the Emmy Awards this week or next week? Or?
I don't know, but it's soon.
Yeah, they won, or I think they won the Emmys for the broadcast on 60 Minutes.
Oh, is that right?
Very well be,
I think it's the 16th or something like that. I don't know.
that would be good. That would be helpful to the community. Yes, it would.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, I don't think, what's interesting is that I don't think any of these present vocations that have come in have come in because of that reason.
No.
But so it's funny, you know, that we have gotten a lot of attention, but
has it helped with donors or?
It has helped with donors, yeah. That's what's important about it.
Remember, contributions can be time, talent, and treasure. So the talent is all
God in them.
Yes.
Yes, but I'm talking about for the last year's experience, what for the last year's just mentioned, what for the last year has said about the Merino products.
Yeah.
A similar experience when I went to Ghana this summer. Mm-hmm. In my village, there's a hospital, a missionary hospital. It's run by the Brothers of St. John of God. Mm-hmm. That's the order, St. John of God. They were about seven. Brothers, they don't call them monks, they call them brothers. So I used to go to their monastery and pray with them every time. Every morning they had the mass. And then their vespers, they just recite the rosary. And they maybe take a couple of psalms. And they just, and I would do it with them every day for 2 months. They were surprised that I was always there. I said, well, good to know what can happen.
Yeah.
But there was that big difference with the way they did this and the way you guys were here. There's a big difference.
Yeah.
So yeah, you're right.
You are getting holier. Yeah.
I think it was in the 1980s when Father John Gorski started going to daily mass again.
Oh.
I don't know if he was celebrating it every day, but he started at least attending or kind of celebrating. Maybe he started actually celebrating every day, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But because after Vatican II, he said the priest didn't have to celebrate Mass every day. Yeah, but every priest should at least go to Mass every day.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, you don't have to celebrate it, you don't have to be the principal celebrant. So, you know what, there was this young brother, he had joined recently the Marinols, and he started getting after Father John. He says, "You don't celebrate Mass every day, and you don't do the Divine Office." So he got Father John a breviary set, and the missal and whatever, the sacramentary whatever, and he says, "Okay, well, let's do this together." So they would do Mass. Father John would celebrate the Mass, and they would do Divine Office. And it was this young brother that got him back into the routine of doing the breviary and the...
That's great. That's really nice.
Yeah.
During World War II, a lot of people went to church every day, and there were all kinds of novenas. Once the wars were over,
oh, yeah,
they stopped going to church. Mm-hmm. The whole cycle changed,
right?
Yeah. Yeah. In the way of living for everybody.
Yeah. Well, people tend to go to turn to God in time of need. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah.
When things are going well,
there's no need to pray.
Yeah. So now that we're getting vocations, I don't know if I need that holy hour anymore.
They have to
there it
stay.
Is. Right in front of you.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I got it for perseverance. That's right.
Satan. I really think that young people today are looking for more, from what I've been reading, when they're attracted to a vocation. I think they're looking, they want to wear the habit, you know, they don't want like the, you know, wear street clothes or whatever. They're more like into, you know, the holy hour, the divine office, you know.
Right.
I think it's great.
Yeah, and I think religious orders, they're not flexible, that won't, you know, kind of readapt and bring back a lot of that stuff that the young people are interested in.
Right.
They're not going to get vocations.
Mm-hmm.
So we had already started a reform, bringing back the divine office mm-hmm. and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you know, but these young guys, they're very interested in community life.
Mm-hmm.
We have recreation every night, you know. We play cards for four, we use foreign coins though, foreign money. Because if you win, you can't use it. So we got a lot of it's real money.
Yeah.
Some from China,
okay.
Italy,
that's cute.
Great Britain.
Wow.
But you can't spend it. Well, sometimes we play dominoes, but we don't play that for money.
Oh.
And last night, Father Albert was saying, you know, that in the past, you know, the days of the Latin Mass, people didn't put enough in the collection. The priest would say, Dominico Friscum.
Dominico
Friscum. And they would answer by calling the number of the Vatican. Ecum Spiri 220.
That's cute.
Know the phone numbers.
Oh, that's so funny.
Those are Dominican jokes.
But anyway, you know, I really, you know, like the prayer, you know, and work can sometimes get in the way of prayer, you know. I mean, so my grandfather said something very interesting. See, both of my grandfathers were heavily into, winemaking, and my mother's father was into, he had a distillery, so making harder stuff. So when he used metaphor, he tended to talk about the distillery, but I remember one time he said, work is just work, and it only becomes service when it's distilled. He used the word Eucharistic contemplation, because that it distilled in Eucharistic contemplation, because they think in terms of Eucharist. But in general, you just say in contemplation, in prayer, you have to distill. It has to be distilled. The work has to be distilled. But I remember so the metaphor of the distillery.
Yeah.
And his drinks were delicious, that, by the way.
Which reminds me of an important prayer.
Yeah.
Reminds me of this prayer, and it says, if you drink, go to sleep. And if you go to sleep, you will not sin. And if you do not sin, you will go to heaven. And if you go to heaven, you will see God. So for God's sake, drink.
Okay, well, it doesn't, it's not difficult to convince me. I have my...
Even though you're not from Kentucky.
Wait, can you repeat again what your grandfather said about...
Oh, okay. So, work remains just work,
right,
and doesn't become real service.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he was thinking of charity work,
mm-hmm.
and until it's distilled in Eucharistic contemplation.
And he used those words.
Yes. He spoke in Italian.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, I wonder where something must have touched him to say that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So. And so. They were very, they had a strong orientation to the Eucharist. And like, every meal was like, you know, the Last Supper, you know, with the, you had to bless with the bread and the wine. You had to have bread and wine or it wasn't a meal.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a snack.
That's a survival.
I know know a couple churches that, like there's one at Mount Carmel and Ridgewood that have perpetual adoration. Mm-hmm. And it seems like the churches that have had that have really prospered in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I've seen that other places also.
There's a lot of churches that have it now.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
St. Lucie's has had it for a long time. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, look at, I mean, Mother Teresa. They did a holy hour, I guess, at the start of every day.
Yeah, well, you know, I remember because, see, I volunteered for many years down at their house in D.C., the Gift of Peace House. And, you know, she would come, that was their juniorate there. So she would come there at least once a year, and certainly for the profession.
Right.
And so I got to meet her a number of times. She would always, you know, say to give a little talk or something. And I remember her hearing her say it many times that and this was very important to her, that when she had her initial group of 12 disciples, really, I think it was literally 12 ladies. They were former students of hers, and they came, and because she just started set, you know, she got permission from Rome to have this separate apostolate, which eventually became the Missionary of Charity. But that was, she had those 12, and that there was, she wasn't getting any vocations, you know, any new vocations. And she decided to do the holy hour. She said, I started doing the holy hour, put it the holy hour a day. And then soon after that day, she started getting vocations.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that impacted me. And I thought a lot about that.
And also I think of Archbishop Sheen. I mean, they say that he, no matter whether he was traveling, he would always try to find a church that, you know, had a holy hour, you know, bless the sacrament.
Yeah.
Well, we need that.
Right. You know, when I first started doing the holy hour, I was doing various kinds of prayers, like rosary and things. And I began to realize that the holy hour is really not for that.
No.
The holy hour is to put yourself in the presence of God. And now it's hard for some people to sit quietly for that long. But so if you have to do something, then of course you should go ahead. But I decided, you know, that I made a decision, I'm just going to sit there. And so, you know, I might kind of repeat a mantra prayer that helps me to, but other than that, I generally just sit there. Well, I do start, I have this ever-growing prayer list. So it takes me a while. And I go through the prayer list. I go all for, you know, everybody that I'm supposed to be praying for. And once I'm finished with that, a half hour later.
Well, it's interesting when some of the people who are in the films and the stage and all that, when they're interviewed on the show, like Oprah was interviewed last week. I saw a piece where she was anyway. And it was a repeat from something before. How did she, you know, how did she live her life? And she started, and so many other people have it, say, they start with meditation in the morning, and then they do exercise, and then they do more meditation. And it doesn't have to be, you know, so profound and so deeply religious, but it has to be a point where you have to get your head straightened out before you can do the rest of the day.
Sure.
And don't have to be Catholic to do it.
Right.
Which I find interesting.
An interesting one you know of, but you don't know this about her, Fred Rogers. Everybody know who Fred Rogers was?
Mr. Rogers?
What people don't know, of course, he was ordained a Presbyterian minister. And he was
sent to bring the love of God to children. That was his commission.
Yeah.
He started every day with an hour of meditation.
Yeah, I heard he was one of the people I've heard.
And that's So it's not unique that good people do this sort of thing.
Yeah.
He had an affiliation with St. Vincent Arch Abbey.
Yes. Because he was from La Trobe, yeah. He was born in La Trobe and lived there, yeah. Yes.
Because they have a building named after him, right?
Yes. And there's a little museum piece in the front when you walk in. It's the Fred Rogers Center. And when you walk in the front, there's a little corner kind of museum piece that, like, his wife donated a whole bunch of stuff, like a couple of the sweaters and the sneakers and his old typewriter and things are there in the front corner of that building. So, yeah.
Where is this?
In La Trobe at St. Vincent's.
La Trobe?
La Trobe. Yes. It's near, in that, a little bit west of Pittsburgh. A little bit west of Pittsburgh, yeah. And it is a stop on the train station. It's the train line. And it's, but they are the Mother Abbey. They're your guys. That's the
yes.
Arch Abbey.
They're the Arch Abbey for our congregation. Mm-hmm. The American Cassinese. They were the first to be founded here in the United States. And then we were founded from them. St. John's, I think St. John's was the first to be founded after St. Vincent's was founded. And then there was another one, and then I think ours would maybe the third.
Erie?
No, Erie's not.
Last name, yeah. I don't remember, you know, but I think we were the third to be founded from La Trobe. Or at least, you know, it was early on that they sent somebody. They sent monks here, and it was very soon after they, and then it wasn't until 1857 that we were established as a priory. I think St. Vincent was founded in 1850, so that would be just 7 years after the founding of St. Vincent. But yeah, so.
When you shake the dust, of course, a lot of stuff falls out.
I'm not going to shake it too much today.
You never know. You never know.
But you know, Boniface Wimmer only reluctantly allowed a priory to be established here.
Really?
Because it was already an industrial city. It was already a city.
Oh, yeah.
And he didn't feel that there should be monasteries in the city, even though he had a missionary orientation, but he didn't feel that monasteries should be in the city. Mm-hmm. But he was willing to send priests to parishes, but they had to have a monastery to come back to this.
But this was a high point in the city and it was not developed. Downtown was all developed.
Yeah. But from the beginning, the monks felt that eventually they're going to have to find a place to establish a regular monastery. And that this would be the mission, a mission site. And that's exactly what eventually
happened.
Yeah. St. Mary's Morristown. They got that property out in Morristown, established that as the main monastery, and this continued as a mission of that. And then, but the monks here, the majority of the monks, developed their separate identity and they wanted to be separate.
They're the monks in the hood.
Monks in the hood, yeah.
That's cute. That's what somebody said to me in the shopping parking lot up there at ShopRite.
Yeah. Monks in the hood.
Who else would I find in the hood but you?
But you know that I've learned to. It was like day and night when I left the Trappist. I mean, we had. Well, when I was up there, it was 2,300 acres of land, and you could walk and walk and walk, and and never leave the property. You'd still be in an isolated, property. And it was beautiful. And now they're up to 3,000 acres. So you can imagine it, so they come down here, and our property is It's
2,300
feet. 2,300 feet. So there isn't much. And I lost, because there was, this garden was bigger. So before the hospitality center here, and it was walled in. So there was a kind of isolated outdoor space. But in addition to, and it was a path, the sidewalk went all the way around. You could walk and walk and walk and just keep going around and walking. The cloister walk. And then we lost that by putting this here. So it's reduced in size, and now it's not walled off and private anymore. So we don't really have an outdoor space that's...
That's private.
That's private.
Yeah.
But I did discover you don't have to drive too far. I do like South Mountain Reservation, but that even if you go deep into the woods, it's still not quiet. You still have the sounds, the planes, and you can hear the traffic from the highways and everything. Well, if you go to Eagle Rock Park and you go into the woods, it is absolutely silent. You know, you just hear the birds.
Where?
Eagle Rock Reservation.
Oh, in West Orange?
In West Orange.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, and you don't have to go far. I mean, it's like a 10-minute drive. And you go into the woods there. It's amazing. Talk about silence. So if you want to have some sounds, so there is...
That was nice up at Lucian's woods. The woods.
Yeah, now there, but that's 55 miles. So that's
55 miles away.
Yeah, it's about an hour and a half drive because it's not all expressway going out.
That's right.
So, but I'm talking about somewhere where you could, you know...
Close by where you can...
Yeah, you can go up there in 10, 15 minutes, then spend an hour or so. And
Which campus there were you at? Yeah,
it'd be the Genesee.
Genesee.
Yeah. To this day, I miss it.
I'm sure you do.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're glad you're here.
But this looks the way you're doing. This is
well, you know, that's Brother Simon's initiative.
This looks like you could really get into a concept.
Well, you took the words out of my mouth, so he'll have to be the one to initiate it, and he'll change all this and make it different.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well.
Make it so it's silent.
Well,
and still air conditioned.
Yeah.
Well, air conditioned? What do you mean? I'm coming from Georgia now. It's freezing up here.
Yeah. I mean, this space, which is an indoor space, there's large periods of time where this is not occupied. And it's you come in here for silence, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But it's not an outdoor space. I'm thinking of an outdoor space.
Right.
So there are times you're going to get silence in here. But the only place really you're guaranteed to get silence is your room around here in this place.
Right.
So, and then also we have a meditation chapel.
Oh.
Which, and let me tell you about that meditation chapel. It's a portion of what used to be the choir chapel, which was big. And was where the monks used to do the divine office and their conventual mass, because that church, St. Mary's Church, was a parish church. They came here to staff it, but they didn't have their choir stalls in that church. That was strictly a parish church. And they had their own chapel. It was up on the third floor of the old main building there. And that's where those choir stalls that are in the church now were up there, and still have some stained glass windows up there, so they had their divine office up there. It was in the 1960s, I believe, when the parish had declined so much, you know, it was on the verge of closing, that the bishop turned the deed over to the monks with the condition that you still have to allow parish, you know, to be used as a parish church, right. But it, the deed. So, but I don't know if that was written. I think that was oral. So, I mean, even if we decided that we're not going to have parishioners there anymore, we won't really call them parishioners anymore. They're, what do you call it? A faith community, I guess. Because yeah. it's not a parish anymore. It's called, that's an oratory. Yeah. But anyway, so it was in the 60s. They renovated and they put the choir stalls in there. And so upstairs, the choir chapel was partitioned off, and a suite was made for the prior. So it has office space, bedroom, bathroom, and that's where Father Mark was, you know. But Father Augustine wasn't allowed to move in after Father Mark died, because I'm not sure. There's rumors that the abbot is thinking about when he retires, he wants to go to that suite. But I don't know. That's just a rumor. I don't know if that's the fact. But anyway, it's empty right now.
You'll soon know.
But anyway, so adjacent to that, of course, is the remainder of what was the choir chapel. It's now a meditation chapel. And it's really nice. The Blessed Sacrament is on reserve there all the time.
That's nice.
It's a real nice space, and it's, you know, relatively quiet.
Right.
So you have you learn to make use of these spaces.
Mm-hmm.
So you can get quiet time here.
Yeah. I think what you're talking about, though, is like just so true for everybody now. Like, it's hard to find the quiet between cell phones, computers,
right.
And it seems like we all need it more than ever.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, is it? Okay.
No, it was just up at the Abbey of the Genesee. You couldn't, it was hard to find the noise.
Well, I don't know if she gave a talk to us directly, but she gave it at the conference of Oblates or something about the nun that was saying there's a problem in her community with not having enough silence. And nuns are bringing the phones into choir.
Oh,
and yes. And she said, at this point, she said, let's have a talk about limits. I'm putting some limits on
right.
stuff.
Yeah.
You know, when Mass begins,
yeah.
I know one time I was serving a priest, and he worked for the Archdiocesan Tribunal. Yeah. I won't give you his name, but it was the consecration, and the day before he suffered, looked at his cell phone, said to me, that can wait, off, and he took bread and was, now give me a break. He's got to go off when you go to church, you know, and you don't have them on, but just turn them off.
Yeah.
Nothing is that critical.
Would you ever look at some of these families that go out to dinner and everyone's sitting at the table looking at a cell phone?
Yeah.
Nobody's talking. Yeah.
I remember I used to sing in the choir
at
St. Mary's, and it was becoming a real nuisance, you know, these phones going off. And it throws you off when you're singing, you know. So Justina led the effort to put up these signs. You see, you can still see some of them. They're not all there. Mm-hmm. To remind people, especially in the vestibule coming in, to remind you to turn off your phone.
Yeah.
So it wasn't long after the signs were put up. There was this one Sunday, five times phones went off. And they were all choir members.
Excuse. Well, let's hope the music was...
No, but it doesn't. It almost doesn't happen anymore. I mean, I very rarely. I go to that. Well, I haven't been going as much because I get Sunday assignments. But I mean, you know, I very rarely hear that happening now. People are getting into the habit of shutting off their phones.
Yeah. Our place now is no gum chewing.
And no cell phones.
Yeah.
No cell phones and no
coffee.
Yeah.
And I've done every one of them in front of the pastor,
never,
and he has told
chewed,
me.
Never chewed gum. Mm.
Oh, yes, I have.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we were going through this period where, you know, gum was appearing underneath the The back, oh, of, the back, yeah, of the chairs, underneath the chairs. Sometimes just drop down the floor.
As it used
and
to
then
be.
People step on it, yeah, and then, you know, it's so hard, you gotta scrape it up and everything.
Yeah, yeah. Mm.
But I haven't had that problem.
Since you put the new floor down, it hasn't.
Yeah,
been.
I haven't. Well, maybe it's because I'm not doing the cleaning anymore.
Well,
so it's not my problem anymore. Somebody else's problem.
Yeah. They haven't done it on the new floor.
Was it?
They haven't done it on the new floor.
I haven't seen it, but that doesn't mean it hasn't been done. But
well, yeah, but when we clean, I've always had a.
Three
Yeah, that's what I did. Mm. And I've gone through three of them over there now. But I haven't got it anymore. I don't know where it is. Mm. But we don't need it anymore. But Brother Gary used to get down on his hands and knees every time we hit cleaning and do the floor.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
But with the new flooring down, it hasn't happened.
No, I haven't seen it. No.
There's a few burnt spots.
Oh, yeah.
That's something
but
else.
You know what? And I can tell you, see, I shouldn't name names, but now Father Luke,
pray tell,
because he likes a lot of smoke. He likes a lot of smoke, and he insists that you have it slightly. He'll tell the priest, and he himself will do it. You have it slightly open.
Mm-hmm.
So that to maximize this air that passes through and the amount of smoke.
Uh-huh. Yep.
But then if you have it slightly open and while you're swinging it, pieces of embers can come out and they burn the floor.
Yeah.
That's why you got those burn spots in the floor. It's almost always because of that.
Yeah.
But I never lift, when I'm swinging it, I don't have it, I have it closed. That's why it's closed. It has the holes in there. Air can get through.
Okay, one question, because I have to do the charcoal at Holy Cross. When you light the charcoal, should you close the, what's that thing called?
No, you should, when you light it while it's, starting to burn, so that it'll get to the point where it's burning hot. You leave it open, and then when you're ready to use it, then you put the lid down.
Then you burn. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It's tricky.
Yeah.
What do you have for us today, Father?
Okay, well, so I wanted to, well, we've already started. We were talking about vocation and a little bit about my own vocation. I probably said this before. So the Canaanite woman kind of typifies lessons that I've learned in my life. And of course, I mentioned one, like the kind of a very Eucharistic orientation, like my grandfather's saying things like that, work doesn't become service until it's distilled in prayer, to Eucharistic meditation, contemplation. So, now, of course, there some people have a religious instinct in their genes, and I think I probably, it's like a genetic trait.
Mm.
So you can't, that's, and I would say, just sort of, like my mother, when she was carrying me in the womb, she said she had this premonition, she said, oh, this one's going to be very religious. And then that's why she named me Peter Paul. I think she probably spun in her grave when I took the name Maximilian, but but anyway, but the thing is that I turned out to be very religious. And I just was attracted to things religious, And as soon as I got old enough to be able to serve at Mass, I wanted to be a server. Mm-hmm. I learned the rosary early on, and used to pray the rosary. And then I used to like to have holy pictures and candles, flowers, and all that stuff. And, I remember, speaking of flowers, My Aunt Rosalie, well, all my aunts used to refer to this bush, this shrub, as the St. Anthony bush. And the flowers that it produced in June, St. Anthony flowers. Well, they at least at the latitude we were at, up in Connecticut, they blossomed around June 13th.
Oh, wow.
So they call it Sandra, and then they would collect those flowers and put it at the St. Anthony statue. And so I just assumed that those were called St. Anthony flowers. So, but I remember one day, the lady up the street, Stacia, she was one of the few non-Italians in our neighborhood, Stacia Urban. She was actually Lithuanian. She was at our house, and she and my Aunt Rosie started getting into an argument. And my Aunt Rosie called them, you know, St. Anthony flowers, and said, "No, no, no." Stacia said, "Those are mock orange." No, and I went, "No, no, those are St. Anthony flowers." My mother told me that. "No, no, those are St. Anthony flowers." No, Stacia said, "No, no, no, those are called mock orange." And they just went at it. They went at it for an hour. And my Aunt Rosie wouldn't let down. And my Aunt Rosie went to a grave. She would say, "Those can't be mock orange. Those are St. Anthony flowers." I looked it up. That it's mock orange. I don't remember the Latin name, but it's commonly referred to as mock orange because they kind of look like orange blossoms, and you know, they have a Latin name too. But St. Anthony isn't part of that name. And it doesn't listen. If you look at any book on shrubs and flowers or anything, you won't find St. Anthony as being used for that. So I don't know, somehow it just got, you know, I don't know who got started calling them St. Anthony flowers. But anyway, I look forward to St. Anthony for the bread and the flowers. Yeah. But anyway, so So I think I had a religious instinct, but I also had and I still do to some extent because I've worked on it, but OCD, very compulsive. I can't stand things out of order. So my room is always very orderly. So, you know, but I when
Don't
I...
come to my house. My dining room table is piled that high.
Yeah. And
that's not kidding.
Right. But you know, the thing is that, so I used to do a lot of work deeds that helped, it served other people, but it had more to do with compulsion. you know, I think in retrospect, you know, that work is just work, even if it's providing some service, it's not real charity unless it's distilled in prayer. You know, you have to be conscious of, you know, that you're doing it for Christ. And you know, so I had my brother Fuhr. He was the exact opposite. It was the odd couple thing. I needed to have things very orderly, clean, and he was just the opposite. And he would never make the bed. Well, we had bunks, and he would never make his bed, but it had to be made. Especially it was the bottom bunk. So I had to make it because he wasn't going to make it. And he would take his clothes off, throw them on the chair, on the floor. He would just, you know, just throw things around and everything. And he knew I was going to pick it up.
That's funny.
So my mother, she would get, you know, she would get upset if anything was out of order. She was compulsive too. So she didn't have to worry about our room. She was always yelling at Ralph, you know, Ralph and Robert shared the other room. And, but one day I said, you know, I said to myself, I'm not gonna do this. And it was very difficult for me to not do it. And so I don't remember how long this went on. You know, it was at least a day, but maybe more. And it's amazing how just the room, my brother just had a huge mess. It was a mess. Stuff all over the place. And And of course, the bed not made, his bed, his bunk wasn't made. And so my mother came in, we were sitting there, and she said, if you don't clean this room, you better clean this room. If I come back and this room isn't clean, I'm going to bring the big garbage bucket and throw all your toys away. I mean, just throw. And my mother, if she would do what she said. If she said it, she would do it.
Ooh.
So Fuhrer looked at me, and I looked at him, and I said, Fuhrer, I'm not going to do it because I always do it. And he says, oh, do it for Christ's sake. So I thought for a minute, I said, you know, I knew I was going to be doing it. He wasn't going to do it. But I said, well, I'm going to do it for Christ's sake, not for your sake.
You know?
So,
and that's how it got done.
Yes, I did it for Christ's sake. But I really wasn't doing it for Christ's sake either. I was doing it because I didn't want my toys to be thrown away.
Aww.
So, actually, because I forgot what the reason was. Maybe, I don't know if it was a mess or something, but you know, she threatened, I'm going to take the garbage can and throw all your toys away. Well, I remember one day she made good on it. She started, I was going in there and I was crying and my toys are going into the garbage can, you know. So she put it out, and then of course we took everything out and brought it back in. But it's, you know, she made good on it. Mm-hmm. She made good on it. She did it one Christmas too. Mm-hmm. The boys were, you know, misbehaving. And she says, Santa Claus isn't coming this year. Yeah. Santa Claus didn't come. She didn't know, there was nothing under the tree. So it's a good thing, you know, we have godparents and everything, and we got presents from them.
That's funny.
So yeah, she made good on her threats. So but anyway, that's an important lesson though. I mean, parents are always threatened, oh, Santa Claus isn't gonna come, but then he always comes anyway, no matter how.
I know a lady who did that. She told her grandchildren they didn't pick up the things. The mother was sick and she was taking care of them. Mm-hmm. If you don't pick up your things, I'm going to throw them in the basement. And she did. Oh, they were furious. And then they had to go down in tears and pick all of them and put the stuff away. They never did it again.
The problem with that is that
she didn't have permission to throw it out, but she made them do it.
Yeah.
That's so good. You have to have little secrets like that.
A year and a half ago, the list went up for Christmas for my grandson. And on the bottom it says real trains and real tracks. And I'll never forget it. I went to Bridget, his mom, and I said, you got two choices. You live across from the Burlington Northern. I said, I will spend a considerable amount of money to put a siding over there and buy one private car so we can vacation in. She looked at me half unbelieving, just, what's option two? I said, liar now. Which has, by the way, those have stayed in one place, so kids have not taken them all over. Sorry.
But two Lionels, and she disagreed with that.
Table, no. Mm.
Mm. Oh, for Christ's sake, that's a good one.
Yeah, that was curious.
I guess he knew you couldn't refuse that.
He knew you.
Was he the older brother or younger?
He's older than me, yeah.
Well, he was older, so he should have been telling you to pick up your things, you know.
Yeah. Well, Ralph did the same thing, too. Ralph shared a room with my youngest brother, Robert. And Ralph didn't do any cleaning. But Ralph wasn't a messy person, though. Mm-hmm. But Ralph never did any cleaning. Robert did all the cleaning. So it was the younger brother that...
That's fine.
Yeah. My sister had her own room, so she had to do her own cleaning anyway, so she couldn't get anybody to do it.
Poor thing. At least she had her own room. That's
sad. But, yeah.
That's cute.
So,
husbands and wives have that problem, too.
Yeah.
anyway, but my mother had this strict rule. See, my father was a hoarder, you know, sort of. But he, because he saved stuff, and you know, so he would accumulate stuff. But there was an agreement that he would not store stuff in their room, their bedroom. Now, my mother wasn't a hoarder, but she managed to accumulate quite a bit of stuff. But it wasn't like, because if my father was allowed, that would have been barely a walk space, you know, to get through that room.
Yeah.
You know, so she kept
that. Yeah, but in the days that they grew up, it was different than the days when you grew up. I want kids to grow up today. They throw everything out.
Right.
Nobody saves anything. Nobody recycles anything.
You know, I remember we used to go to, because my father, he lived through the Depression. And, you know, another man's garbage is, one man's garbage is another man's treasure.
Yeah.
You know, they used to go to the dump to get stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and the ladies used to save the stuff from the shirt factories and the patches. That's how they made the patch quilts.
Yeah.
Because they didn't have blankets. And look at the fad it is today.
Yeah. Well, I remember when we were growing up, you know, by the time I came into the world, we were doing fine in middle class status. But my father still made regular trips to the dump.
Oh, yeah.
Bring and take. We'd come back with more than we brought. And so, I mean, some of my best toys I got from the dump.
Now, I had an art teacher. I had an art teacher who used to go through the suburbs when they put out the trash, the cleanup week, and pick up stuff and bring it back to school. Now, I know one of the things that he did when he left my school, because he had more room in the other school that he went to, was pick up furniture that was out on the and he brought it to Burnett Street School here in Newark for his shop class, because they didn't have much in the way of supplies. And he'd get the kids to fix that furniture. They reupholstered, they finished, put finish on where there was scratches and things like that. Put it on the staircase, and any family that came in and needed furniture for getting the house, because that school had more homeless children in it than any school in the city. They could pick up the furniture there, and he gave it to them for nothing. Made a real charity out of it.
Yes.
And that's modern day, today.
Yeah.
And then he brought a teddy bear to my school when he was working with me. And Linda came, little Linda, who has her own baby now. But she came to school with me, and he went to the classroom, and he got the teddy bear, and gave her the teddy bear. She says, Alice, you wouldn't let me play with it until you put it in the washing machine. I still have it.
Well, you know,
those are good things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We never wash the things. We bring them to the dump and we use them.
You clean them up a bit.
But I remember one of the most sacred things, most favorite things that I ever got from the dump was this bust statue of the Sacred Heart. It's a, you know, And it was, well, what paint was still on it was faded, and then, you know, the paint was all chipping off, and, you know, maybe it may have been an outdoors thing, and, you know, so people just threw it away, probably bought another one, you know. So when I saw that, I said, so I brought it home and I said, well, it's got to be painted. So I went to the store, and well, you know what, I didn't know what kind of, I bought this model paint. And I painted, you know, I did it nice. And and I had it on, you know, our dresser all the years, you know, the rest of the years we were growing up. And then I went off, I didn't take it with me. Well, my brother Fjord has it, and he has it in his living room, and he won't give it back to me. I told him, that's really mine. He said, no, it's not yours, it's mine now.
We have a, I don't know how it, there was a statue from Fenwick. Somehow, it got ended up in the cemetery in another suburb. And they found it, and then they resurrected it and got it refinished, and it's back at school, and it was a whole big article about it. My daughter's school is Fenwick.
Well, look at the statue up in the library. The one that went through the fire when the church was burned.
Yeah, and they got the head back.
They held on to that for a long, they're still holding on to it.
Yeah.
And they found the head?
The whole thing?
They found the head, yeah. They found, well, when they first recovered it, whoever recovered the body of the statue didn't find the head. Mm. 30 years later, they get a call, or get a call or something from St. Vincent Arch Abbey and say, we found the head of the statue. Mm-hmm. And he was in a monk who he must have been here at the time. And he found the head, and he had it in his room. Mm-hmm. When he died, they found it.
So, oh, my goodness.
But you see, it's all broken up, like the back was so busted up.
Yeah, button.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a,
it
it's
tells
a memento.
Story of, yeah, it tells a story. There.
Right.
Hmm.
There was you know, a violent time. But yeah, that stuff still goes on, destroying of churches, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Prejudice. And, yeah. So.
That's what they did to St. Lucie's in the parking lot. Mm-hmm. Maybe headed all the states.
Oh, yeah.
Mm. But they fixed them all.
Yeah.
Mm. They fixed them all.
Yeah, they broke the St. Michael's statue in front of St. Michael's Church.
Yep. And then the Indian's head came off down in front of the library.
Yeah.
He was beheaded too. That wasn't too long ago either.
Yeah, that was, that could be as many as 10 years ago.
Was, oh, yeah. Maybe 10, maybe 20 years ago. Hmm. But, I mean, it's within our lifetime. It's not a thing that is 100 years old.
Right.
That was after the riots.
Well, probably don't have too much more time, but I want to, you know, just talk about the, I guess that this, you know, message from Scripture, the Canaanite woman, Canaanite woman's faith. So I want to talk about that, because that is important. There are three important lessons. I didn't always learn it from the same place, you know, because certain role models emphasize something, one aspect, but another role model will. So then you put it all together. As you're growing up, you put it all together. Mm-hmm. You know, and you don't get it all from one single role model.
Right, that's for sure.
So why don't I have somebody read the passage in Matthew 15? Who would like to read?
John.
Somebody else.
Matthew.
What?
Read.
Yeah, it's from Matthew, so.
Just
read the passage.
The whole paragraph?
Yeah, the whole paragraph. Yeah.
Oh, that's the whole paragraph. All right. All right. Okay, it's.
The other paper.
On the back of Cana?
Yeah, on that one. Yeah.
On the front.
No, 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 on the front, the very first paragraph.
First paragraph.
Oh, okay.
All right. Jesus left that place and went away to the district of Tyre and Sidon. Just then, a Canaanite woman from that region came out and started shouting, "Have mercy on me, Lord, Son of David. My daughter is tormented by a demon." But he did not answer her at all. And his disciples came and urged him, saying, "Send her away, for she keeps shouting after us." He answered, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." But she came and knelt before him, saying, "Lord, help me." He answered, "It is not fair to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs," she said. Yes, Lord, yet even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from the master's table. Then Jesus answered her, Woman, great is your faith. Let it be done for you as you wish. And her daughter was healed instantly. Matthew 15, verse 21 through 28.
You know, I remember when I used to hear that passage read and, you know, have this feeling that, you know, that was a mean thing to do. You know what I mean? And to humiliate her that way, deliberately humiliating her. But, you know, see, we don't have the mind of Christ. I mean, he could see something in her that he wanted to develop, you know, that she was ready to make that. She'd already ventured in faith to step outside of her comfort zone in the sense that, you know, the Canaanites had their own religion, right? Their own practices. And so she's coming to this person who she sees as prophetic and, you know, is not connected with her religion. So he could see that. So she was already stepping out of her comfort zone in faith, you know, and actually leaving behind her practices in some sense. And so she wanted to develop it, but she had already made the first step, and he wanted her to get her through the second step. So we have the first, second, and third steps, which I'm talking about. So the first is a movement of faith that prompts us daily. And I'm talking about daily, because this is something that's a daily thing. But I mean, you know, so it's not just like a once-in-a-lifetime thing. Movement of faith that prompts us daily to step outside our comfort zone. Okay. So, we always have to, see, we could get into a very comfortable pattern. And faith, and so many times in our life, we really need to step out of our comfortable pattern, to really make the act of faith and that God is asking us, you know, though it may not be comfortable. So the second is a self-abandonment, and that's what he was prompting her towards, self-abandonment, even to the point of accepting humiliation in order to open us to receive God's loving embrace. And this is not, you know, like something that happened. It can't, there can be like these dramatic moments in your life and then you remember when it happened. You know, you go through a real humiliation. But it's only, and of course, the Saint Benedict, you know, puts a big emphasis on humility and emphasizes the fact that we should take humiliation. And for the sake of growing humble, because that's when we can be open. It's only in that condition that we can be open to, first of all, receiving God's word, but open to his loving embrace, which then we can extend to other people. And that's what the third step is, the movement of charity in God's loving embrace. So you're in God's loving embrace. Spills over to heal and fill with evangelical joy those around us. So we become open to God's love. God's love cannot come in and embrace us if we are stuck in our comfort zone and closed to that, you know, because we're feeling, you know, well, I just, you know, like to have the things I like to have and doing the things I like to do. It usually, becoming open to God's loving embrace is often being, sometimes even being brought to the edge of real, like, you feel like, I don't know if I can go on anymore. You know, it's really things pile up, or there's, you know, a lot of things happening, suffering of some sort, you know. But it's often on that edge there that's where God meets you, and you receive the graces to not just move forward with, you know, your ability, your skills, but with God's love, right? That's what you put into it. Like when I think about my grandfather's saying that, so, you know, yeah, you got to keep on strive, work, you know, and no matter how, you know, if you feel like you can't do it anymore, you just keep going, you know. But the thing is that if you're just doing that from a purely human point of view, you're really not, well, you're not serving God, certainly. You're not serving God. And you're not really serving others in love. It's almost like a selfish, I'm going to make it, you know. And it's more like an achievement. So, and that's what, and that's been like a key to my vocation. Because I feel that I kind of fell into a pattern where achievement became so important. It's interesting because I was very religious, so you would say, well, why would that happen to someone who's so religious? Well, that was the reason why I got this article. So I'm not going to read it. You can read it on your own, but he talks about Catholic schools, but he's talking about, you know, another time, not all Catholic schools this way, but the Catholic school, and he talks about Catholic schools in Connecticut. And I grew up in Connecticut. And Catholic schools were very competitive, you know, and, you know, everybody wanted to be better than the other, you know. And and everybody was proud of these, you know, famous people that came from their school. And I know my headmaster, what we call the principal, but he, Father John Blanchfield, and he would talk about these certain famous alumni all the time, you know. And he emphasized, you know, you have to become a master of yourself, and to be successful, but to be successful in life, but also be successful in doing God's will. Well, you know, so doing God's will becomes an achievement. You know what I mean? And so it's almost like that's what the Pharisees were doing. You know, you're doing God's will. It's like an achievement. And when I look back, and I do have to, I have to say, because my school was good, and it was a lot, you know, there was religion there, but it was a very, you know, almost Pharisaical type of, you know, becoming a master of yourself, so doing God's will was an achievement, you know, and I think that kind of got into the mix there, and so even my religion maybe started becoming like that. But then there was other things, like the teachers. There was a lot of labor because there was a big decline in the after Vatican II in the number of religious vocations. So there was a lot of lay people. And they were emphasizing, you know, they would look at your abilities and skills and encourage you in certain directions. And I was encouraged, you know, people, oh, you know, you have ability with math and science, you know, so you could be an engineer, you could be a doctor or whatever, you know. And so then I started shifting toward a career. And then, of course, my father, my grandparents came here with nothing, so, and they kind of moved to the middle class, and my parents, their generation did better, but they wanted, you know, none of them were getting into the professions. So I was, you know, in my generation going on to college. And so going into a profession, and my father was so proud of me when I became an engineer. Yeah. So, you know, and he was disappointed, actually. It took him a while to accept. And my mother would have been very happy if I left being an engineer to become, you know, a religious. And then my father came to accept it, of course. He was happy, you know. But but disappointed, you know. But I you know, I was an engineer doing, you know, achieving, you know, making good money, and but I realized that I wasn't being true to myself, to what I, you know, I recognized myself that I was called to be, and I knew that I had to let go of my professional career. So, and I was really blessed. I got connected with this Jesuit professor. And he was a Jesuit spiritual director. I don't know if he was teaching anymore at the time, but he was still available for spiritual direction. And we went through the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius. It took 9 months because I didn't do the 30-day thing. You know, I had gotten interested in, you know, I was going to be a priest. And, you know, and the more I reflected in terms of, really look, St. Ignatius makes you look at your, that very tendency in you to want to turn your good works into like a personal achievement rather than doing it for the glory of God and doing it for, you know. So, and I could see that even my my pursuit of the priesthood was becoming that. It was like a substitute for my professional career. And so I eventually decided, you know, I'm not gonna pursue the priesthood. I'm gonna go into a monastic community. And that's how I ended up going into the Trappist. Because I felt that I really needed to, you know, give, really let go, you know, really. And that wasn't easy. I mean, I spent my 5 years, well, not the whole five, but a lot of the 5 years, really missing my professional career. And the things I could do with the money, but the work and the people, it was good though. It was really good, and I often wondered. See, I had second thoughts after I made the decision that I was going to ship. I felt that there probably was something in me still wanting to achieve in my decision to come here, the transfer, not just stay there and just let go of, you know. And so because I could see that, I did not, the monks could remember, I did not work in the school for the first, was about 7 years. I was here, only in the monastery. I worked in the infirmary. I remember I took care of Father Benedict and Father Emilian, Father Malachy, and so.
Matthew.
Well, he was later, and I did help take care of him. So, and then, you know, of course, I got involved with the kitchen, doing kitchen work, one of the first things the abbot did when I got here was buy a sewing machine, because, see, I got to know him because I was working in the tailor shop up at the Abbey of Genesee, and they didn't have a monk tailor here. So if he had some items that needed to be repaired, he would bring them with him when he'd go up there, you know, on his little retreats. So he'd come into the tailor shop. And I'd have to bring out my black thread. You know, we had the white habits, but we did have the black scapular. But the things that needed most repairing were those tunics. So we were most of the time the white thread was in the sewing machine. when he would get there, you know, when I see him there, I'd go and go get the black thread out. But anyway, so we would, you know, we'd have some conversations, and so, you know, and then we would talk about St. Benedict's and stuff like that. And so, I mean, that's how I got interested, was a father, for Abbot Melvin. So I eventually did come, and, you know, and I remember the rationalizations that I was using. And of course, I realized that all these rationalizations, of course, it's all the devil, you know. But I remember one of the rationalizations. I said, because we're so isolated, you know. Now, we didn't have newspapers, and of course, no television, no radio. And in 1993, I don't know if anybody remembers, but there was an eclipse of the sun there. And it turns out that the Abbey of the Genesee, that location was in the full eclipse zone, or almost full, like it was like 99.9 or something like that, very close to being full eclipse. So I had no idea it was going to happen. But the thing is that Providence allowed me to see it, because so what happened was that day I had, in the afternoon, I had outdoor work that I had, because I had indoor chores, because I was working, because we all worked in kitchen, the bakery, I worked in the library, I worked in the infirmary, I worked in the tailor shop, and I also had outdoor chores. So that day I just, there was some outdoor chores I had to get going. You know, sometimes I had to use this little tractor with a brush hog, and I drove that off the cliff, you know, at least three times. I just trying to, but anyway, I had to go out and do my chores, and I get out there, and something is strange, because it's almost like a cloud cover, mm-hmm. but the sky was perfectly clear.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
I was looking, wow, this is weird, you know? Huh. And so then I look over toward the church, and by divine providence, we had workers. They were redoing the roof tiles on the church. They were all stopped there near the church, and I saw one of them with a welding glass looking up toward the sun. I said, oh my goodness. I ran over. He handed me the welding glass, and there was a full eclipse of the sun. Can you imagine that?
Unbelievable.
But anyway, I said to myself, well, we're so isolated. I said, I didn't miss it, but I said, I could have missed that. And I kept saying to myself, mm-hmm. I said, you know, these monks are so isolated.
Yeah. Wow.
You know, and I kept, that kept, you know, but that was the devil, really, because the fact is that God, in God's providence, yeah, you know, I saw the eclipse of the sun.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's
funny. But I remember also, like, when we felt this, it was about 3.6 mm-hmm. on the Richter scale, and you know, we thought it was a minor earthquake, mm-hmm. and it turned out that mm-hmm. it was collapsing of the salt mines. Areas for 50 years they were using this technique, which left narrower pillars, and that all collapsed. Mm-hmm. And luckily, it was on a Saturday, and there was nobody in the mines, because there would have been a lot of dead people. And then, of course, all the properties underneath it were automatically worthless, because the subsidence houses started developing cracks in them, and some of them had to be abandoned immediately. We didn't know what was going on. And days went by, and finally someone said, yeah, but get us information and post it.
Right.
So he got articles and he posted on the find that, you know, told. So that, you know, that kind of bothered me. That was something that did bother me.
Yeah.
Now, I have heard that they do now, they get the daily newspaper up at the Abbey of the Genesee. Mm-hmm. They still don't have television and radio. Mm-hmm. Although I remember, first of all, I always wondered how this one monk, I just can't remember his name. Who's the electrician? What's his name?
It's right on the tip of my tongue. I can't remember. Something with a B.
Yeah. But anyway, he seemed to know, like, he very current on what was happening in baseball. He had this obsession with baseball, and he seemed to be current on it. I just figured he was just getting information from the lay people that worked for us, and, you know. But as it turns out, the abbot allowed him to have a little radio so he could listen to baseball games in his room. But he would, he knew, he was completely current on what was happening in baseball.
That's funny.
So I should have, you know, I should have gone to the abbot and said, you know, I need to have a radio because I was trying to figure out what would be my excuse, but I'm sure I could come up with a good excuse. But, you know.
You still haven't, though.
Huh?
You still haven't.
No, I don't. But anyway, so, you know, so that's, that was the thing. You know, I always felt that, you know, there is that desire in us to achieve, and that's fine because we have to develop our skills, our talents, and so forth. If we want to contribute, and God wants us to use our talents in contributing, but He wants us to do it in charity, in love, and. So sometimes, really, and all the time, I mean, we have to, but in order for it to become love, in order to become charity, there has to be the self-abandonment. And, oh, 5 minutes, I got to say no. So anyway, just like, I'll just talk, because I gave a homily to monks, it was, the passage on the talents, you know, the landowner, he goes away and he has 3 servants. He gives one of them, what is it, 3 talents?
1 talent.
Well, there's 2 versions of it. One he gives, in one version, one gets 5 talents, one gets 2 talents, one gets 1 talent, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the other version, the one I think that was, that's, it was this 3, 2, and 1. Mm-hmm. So the one who got the 3, invested and got 3 more, and when I got 2 invested, got 2 more. But the one with the 1 just buried it. And so, you know, I focus on the idea, the ones that earn, you know, the truth is there was a self-abandonment there. They didn't use their gifts. We talk about talents. They didn't use their talents. They just simply gave it to somebody, you know, to a banker who used his talents. Mm-hmm. Yeah. To earn on the investment, but there was a self-abandonment. They had to let go of that. There was a letting go, and that's where the other guy, the third guy who buried it, went wrong.
Right.
He needed to have control. Mm-hmm. Burying it means I have complete control over that. Mm-hmm. So there was no chance that I was going to lose. So the other guys, by investing, there was a chance that they would have lost.
Right.
And that, you know, as the third guy said, you know, well, I know you're very demanding, you know, and, you know, you might have been angry if I, you know, if I lost. Well, I think, of course, Jesus doesn't say this, but of course, in the mind of Jesus, that the two, if they after investing, lost because of the market,
right.
He would have said the same thing to them. Good and faithful servant, because the faithfulness. See, so even I lost, but I tried.
You know,
that's it. So that's there's got to be this self-abandonment to open up to God's love, which we can then give to other people. So that's the point. So I think I've put in my 2 cents.